Now, I think it was 3-4 weeks ago, I talked about the four horsemen of the marriage apocalypse. And it was a very hard but honest observation about marriages. Keep critiquing, stonewall, keep defending, like you're going to end up obliterating that relationship that you hold so dearly. That was some super bad news, but honest. Well, let's go back to Gottman. This is what he says on the flip side, okay? This is the Gottman Institute. He says, now again, these are stats. It's hard to even quote stats anymore, but there's a lot of research this guy's done. He says, the deterring factor in whether wives feel satisfied with the sex, romance, passion in their marriage is by 70% the quality of the couple's friendship. For men, the deterring factor is by 70% something else. No, it's the quality of the couple's friendship. So men and women come from the same planet after all. It's his point. He's saying, we think like we're going to be really, we think we're so different. That no, you come down to it, we're humans created by a relational God who have a thirst and hunger for relationships, for friendship, for intimately sharing our lives with someone. So with that, maybe in just the back burner of your mind, let's look at Song of Songs, chapter 5, okay? If you haven't been with us, this is just, Song of Songs means the greatest album of all time. And we get to look at it like you are opening up a CD, an old CD. I guess I should update my, like you're listening to Spotify and you click the lyrics icon. That's what we're doing. I always think of like 1994, I would buy a plastic CD, open it, and then wrangle the paper out of it, rip it a little bit, but then get to just walk through all the lyrics and think, these 22-year-olds are so witty and thoughtful and deep. It's like, and then I'm like, now I'm like, these guys are so dumb. Why did I listen to them? Why did I listen to them? They're like 6 years older than me. What was I thinking? But this is what we're doing. Which should just help. This is some maturity here. This is some good songwriting, meaning it's breathed out by God, so it's the greatest of all time. All right? Caleb, what chapter, or what page was it? 596. So if you don't have a Bible, I'd love for you to grab a Bible beneath your chair, take it home with you, but just look at it. Look at this song with me. 596 was the page. We are chapter 5, verse 2. So the woman starts off, if you don't recall, it ended with like the center of the book with God saying, eat, drink, be intoxicated with caresses. Like that's the central aspect of the book is the narrator, aka I think God, and if you don't think it's God, well, God still wrote the book, so it is inevitably God. And he says, eat, drink, and be intoxicated with caresses. And then here we go. Now the wife, woman singing. I was sleeping, but my heart was awake, a sound. My love was knocking. Now pause here, because some of us don't pause here a little bit and just think, what might happening? And then we just go through this very quickly like this is her singing of a historical account. But she's half awake, half asleep. Her body's asleep, her mind's racing, maybe even dreaming is what's happening. This whole section has a dreamlike quality about it, okay? I mean, if they're married, why is he knocking to get into his own house? If they're married, why did he leave so fast? Why did he give up so fast? Why are city guards, who were not a threat in chapter 3, now beating this woman? And then if she's bloody and bruised, why does she address the young women like so calmly? And doesn't even talk about the attack. She just, all to say, these kind of bizarre events and unexplained situations and sudden shifts like that happen, those are more like dreams than real life. And so we don't know exactly what's happening, but again, it's a song, and you should feel like, oh, this is a song. This may not be a historical account. We need to know all the factual details, everything, and piece it and parse it apart. We can actually let it pull us into the song and form us how songs do. So let the song sing. He knocks, and then what's he singing? Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my perfect one, for my head is drenched with dew, my hair with droplets of the night. This is a tender request. my sister, my darling, my love. This emphasizes their relationship, them two. You are a precious person to me. My dove, my perfect one. This is emphasizing her beauty. And notice, the dove is no longer hidden in the clefts, right? She's no longer inaccessible to him. In marriage, they are accessible to one another, sexually. And that's the goal of his request. He's not just saying, open the door. He's saying, open up sexually, like this is where this is heading. Because if you don't know, his wetness means something. This is not just him saying, I ran home, or I came from 24-hour fitness, and I can't stop sweating. That's not what he's saying. I need a clean shower. That's not what he's saying. In the last chapter, her moisture symbolized her readiness to receive him. Like over and over again, like there's lakes and ponds and waterfalls, like so much water in her garden. Okay? Now him, it's switch. His readiness, and also probably his frustration of being locked out of his own house. Right? He's like, I want you. You won't let me in. I want you. You won't let me in. Yeah, that's what's happening. But there's a title missing here that you should take note of. Sorry for anything else. But there's a title that's missing, a title that he's used before. You should take note of. What title? He says, my friend, my darling, my lover, right? These words. He doesn't say my bride. That's interesting. It's interesting. I think it seems like he doesn't want to stress the legal aspect of their union. He doesn't want to lead with the foot of, you are my wife legally. Do you feel that pressure? Do you feel a little of that weight that comes behind of it? My friend, my lover, I'd love to come to you, has a different tone than my bride, the one that's covered to me, the one that's vowed to me, open up. It's a little different, right? So he's not trying that. Because if he did, that request would sound less like a request and more like a requirement. Especially in this culture where it was normal for husbands to make demands. He doesn't want that. A lover not demanding sex. I don't know if a lover does that. Does a lover demand sex? I don't think so. I think a lover requests and woos and pursues. Now more on this later. But he's asking to come her. His gal is infatuated with him, so let's see what she says. Okay? Like she's just, you're my young stag, right? That's where we've been. And all right, now what does she say? Verse 3. I've taken off my clothing. How can I put it back on? I don't know, some of you guys musicians, you know, if she did the drop D here, like what she's singing in, but this has gone to some minor notes. I've washed my feet. How can I get them dirty? Our lingo, the sweatpants have been tied. The office has been shut for the night. She's gotten ready for the night. Bedtime. She doesn't really bother to go through that routine again. I already did it. I'm not going to get up and do it again. But remember earlier, in the first chapter, she was willing to risk it to go out and pursue him and seek him, even on the streets, which she could then be construed as a prostitute. She was willing to even like go for him, even if it meant her reputation taking a hit. She was so willing to go after him, and now she can't even walk to the door. The honeymoon is dead. Real life has hit them between the eyes. But seriously, honestly, this song is wildly helpful. Because I said last week, when you have such an idyllic portrait of sex and marriage and purity and passion between husband and wife, it does bring out a lot of the shame and brokenness of us that we don't live up to. That's not our life. That's not our experience. That's not how I sense my marriage to be or even close to. And they're saying, yes, that this is the beauty of marriage. But also this week comes in and says there's also a real difficulty in marriage. It is not always young stags and lilies. Sometimes it's rejection and indifference and coldness. There will be times when selfishness is like another person in your marriage getting in between the two of you. It's like you've invited a third person to be there, but that person is your own selfishness, and they are there getting in between the two of you, creating distance and coldness. Last week I said, I think good sex begins with covenant and communication. And if you want to maybe get better, then throw some time into there. It's going to take time. Add some time. Another ingredient to throw into the dish, choose servanthood over selfishness. If you want great sex in your marriage, choose servanthood over selfishness. Meaning, why do sociologists like Brad Wilcox and others report that born-again Christians, not just like nominal Christians, just by name, but like born-again Christians, have the lowest domestic violence, the lowest divorce rate, the highest marital satisfaction, and the most frequent sex? Why? Why do sociologists report that? Because Jesus' words for our life apply to our life. Even sex. He came to serve, not to be served. That's our leader. That's the king of the cosmos. That's the lead servant. And as we follow him, then that's how we live. And so then what does fuel and what does health and how does a friendship and a marriage grow? This servanthood over selfishness. It is best not to corrupt an act of self-giving by making all about self-taking. Jesus, his life and his words scream for us to show up everywhere ready to serve, even your marriage bed. Some of you guys like math. One pastor puts the formula like this. 1 + 1 = 2. Husband plus wife equals this. Selfish plus selfish, brutal marriage. Imagine. You've been there probably. Selfish plus servant. One is taking advantage, abusing, using, mistreating. Servant plus servant, that's what we're going for. That's why Brad Wilcox is like, well, I mean, I look at all the research and, you know, the highest divorce rate are people that have differing religions, practice different religions. But the highest satisfaction, the most frequent sex, is people, Christians. Why? Because both of them have submitted to Jesus to say, yes, we're both servants. I'm going to serve you. It's a different marriage than most other marriages. They fall in the first two categories. Servanthood over selfishness. She's like, I can't even come. I mean, I can't walk to the door. I can't be bothered to get up. And what does that mean? I have to wash my feet again? No. Verse 4. But something happens. My love thrust his hand through the opening, and my feelings were stirred for him. I rose to open for my love. My hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with flowing myrrh on the handles of the bolt. So the imagery is that she's a locked garden. Again, but now after marriage, this isn't seen in any good light, right? But she sees his hand and she is stirred. Literally, it means in the Hebrew, my insides were in an uproar. Her stirred affections expressed with her hands and her fingers. Like her love is oozing out of her. Like this is how much it's, like this is her affection for him. So she goes to the door. Verse 6, open to my love, but my love had turned and gone away. My heart sank because he had left. I sought him, but not to find him. I called him, but he did not answer. The guards who go about the city found me. They beat me and wounded me. They took my cloak from me. The guardians of the walls, Young women of Jerusalem, I charge you, if you find my love, tell him that I'm lovesick. She says, my heart sank when she opened the door. This is a roller coaster. She goes from indifferent to then she sees his hand, she's stirred, she gets there, he's not there, she dies. Like that's the little is, my soul went out of me. My lover is gone and I died. So she opens, seeks, and calls to no avail. And this is the inverse from him. He called, he sought to unbolt the door, but no opening. Here's a little insight here. They desire one another, but they're not synced up. So they feel separated and alone. The goal is to be moving in the same direction together, but when we're pushed and pulled apart, this is showing us, hey, you're going to be pushed and pulled. So then if that is the case in your marriage, the song to be sung and then the action to be followed in that singing is to move towards your spouse. It's to go after, it's to pursue them, it's to seek them, even if you're the selfish one, or if they're the selfish one that's hurt you, yeah, go after them. Rejection, unmet expectations, selfishness, these all can hurt deeply. And we can withdraw or grow cold or so many options. But again, Jesus' words in life apply to life, even sex, even marriage, even this aspect of your life. In Matthew 5 and 18, he counters our tendency. Our tendency that if there's something between us, then it's their fault, and then they should come to me when they're ready. Jesus counters that tendency and says, if you sin against your spouse, or they've sinned against you, or if you think there's something between you, go to them. Go to them. Go after them. Which in real life, I think, must include humbling yourself, and that's what we don't like. We want all the benefit of our marriage without all the humbling work to get there. The action of actually swallowing our pride and having to go to our spouse and say, yeah, I was wrong. Let that inner lawyer go on a vacation and say, I don't have to keep fighting, and I'm not always right. Why do I always think I am always right? I'm not. I'm finite. I have limited perspective. I sin a lot. And if all that's true, then that means I need Jesus, and he is so good and beautiful and then therefore good to me. I can humble myself and go to myself, even if it means swallowing a bitter pill of pride. Rather point out the other person and not budge. And Jesus counters, no. Your fault, their fault, you're hurt, they're hurt. No matter what, if you're a Christian, if you're in Christ, you go to them. And if you still feel too arrogant, still too staunch in your ways, still so like, just want to fight in your chest. If that's you, consider your relationship with Jesus. You sinned against him. You created the distance. You shunned him. And the supreme lover came after you. And he keeps coming after you. And he keeps pursuing you. Even as you shun him. Even as you treat him like a husband that you don't really care about and you'd rather have other lovers, he keeps coming after you. That's why Christianity is beautiful. If you're not a Christian, that's why Christianity is beautiful. Because I said earlier, not smart, didn't work our steps to get to him. We needed him to come to us, to come after us. So if you're not a Christian, you can keep thinking about marriage and your marriage. But really, the thrust of this is to think about You can try to pursue your wife, you can try to pursue your husband, but first it all begins with who has already pursued you. Someone's already came after you, and someone has already given you the love that you may be demanding or saying you have to get from them. They're human. They can't give and fill your life and your heart with all the love and affirmation and security that you need. Only a God, a supreme being, can do that for you. And in Christianity, it's beautiful because you have a powerful one and a lovely one, and never do they break apart. Perfectly strong and beautifully loving, now and forever. The same yesterday, today, and forever. That's your lover. That's Jesus. So our gal pursues after him. Like, her heart sinks, she sees he's not there, and then she goes after him, but she's attacked, harassed by the city's guards. And again, this is one of those sudden shifts that makes this feel like she's in a dream. Like, because her fear from 1:7 has come to pass, where she thought, hey, I'm going to go out on the streets and people are going to think I'm a prostitute. Now she's seen as a prostitute. They see her cloak, they see her wandering the streets, and they assume, this is a prostitute, this is what they do. They wear cloaks to cover under night, cover their guys, and then they wander the streets. So they beat her. They beat her for her, quote, unwillingness to pursue a lawful sexual encounter with her own husband. I say, quote, because that's what the guards were to do. Part of their job was internally to make sure there's no illicit sexual encounters happening. But that's actually what she's trying to do. She's trying to pursue her husband. And they beat her for trying to pursue not her husband. If they would ask one question, they would have known. This woman doesn't deserve a beating. She deserves help to help her find her husband. Far from wanting any illicit sex, she wants to be with her husband. She's lovesick again, she says. Her premarital angst has returned. And she enlists the young women, join me, help me, find my beloved. And if you don't agree with my observations about the possible dream, well, at the least, you can see this is a song, not a strong, accurate account of events. Why? The young women show up in the middle of the night. Again, randomly. Like on a cloud. And she just talks to him. You're like, wait, you just got beaten, and then all these women pop in? It's like, yeah, this is the chorus of the song. You know, every now and then you just need three gals to pop up, and either they symbolize the audience, or they just kind of affirm what she's saying, and you're like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. But now, what do we do when we are synced up? When we're not synced up. What do we do when we're not synced up? When there is fear of initiating, where there's fear of rejection, where there's unspoken expectations, unmet expectations. Look at me real quick. This is a point in a song that would, like, if you're singing the song, it would make you think, oh, yeah. Yeah. This would be like an R&B love song. Yeah, we'll stick with that. This would be like an R&B love song where you should feel like, yeah, I felt that too. I felt distance. I felt rejected. But more like this would pull you into, like, where are we not synced up now? Where's their rejection? Where's their coldness? Where's their just unwillingness to serve the other person in a staunch selfishness? Or where maybe there's only one initiating, and so the whole burden of this part of your marriage falls on that person. A lot of ways you could be unsynced. Not synced up in this. But 1 Corinthians 7 actually speaks to the scene we see in the Song of Songs. So let's pause, jump to 1 Corinthians 7, and this is what Paul says, if this is you. This is his wisdom for you, if that's you, like unmet expectations, rejection, trying to figure out this frequency, the rhythm of your life, and sex in marriage. He says, a husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise a wife to her husband. A wife does not have the right over her own body, but her husband does. In the same way, a husband does not have the right over his own body, but his wife does. Do not deprive one another, except when you agree for a time to devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again. Otherwise, Satan may tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So this is saying, at the least, two very important things. Number one, the oneness and unity of marriage means that your body is not your body, but your spouse's now. That's what we've been saying. I am his and he is mine. That mutual possession is what he's communicating here. Their body is not their body, but yours. And your body is not yours, but theirs. Which is a great trait, I think, for dudes in this room. Kaylin gets my dad bod and gigantic head and wild hair, and I get her body. That's a good trade. It almost feels lopsided. Our salary caps are way off. My aunt described my hair as a child like carpet. So encouraging. I was like, yeah, that's nice. She's like, this is a shag? I'm like, yeah, it's shag. Everyone loves shag. They always talk about it nicely. So her body is my body, and my body is hers. What this does is put a husband and a wife in the position to outserve one another. Did you hear me? Some of you guys have heard and interpreted this so wrongly. What this does is not put you in a position to demand. It puts you in a position to outserve. I will say it another time. This, men, I'm tired of hearing you quote this to your wife, demanding and requiring sex. Stop it. Please. That's not the point of that. The point is you're to outserve her, not outdemand her. Use her. She is not a tool to make you happy. She is a person to be loved and pursued and wooed and cherished. And if you don't believe me, then you're wrong because I'm right, because that's what Jesus has done. That's how he loves his bride. So argue with him, not with me. But if that's you, that's it. She is not to be used, trampled on, demanded of. We come back to serving, to choose servanthood over selfishness. Romans 12 says in the church we should to outdo one another in showing honor. So that the husband initiates and the wife says, I'm pretty tired, it was a long day, but I want to serve you, so yes. And the husband says, no, baby, it's okay, let's go after it tomorrow, no worries. And she says, no, I want to be with you, I'm just tired. And they seek to serve. That's what it is. Like, I'm trying to serve you, you're trying to serve me, and sometimes it doesn't happen perfectly, but I love you, and it'll be okay, because tomorrow may be a new day. We've got this week. Like, all of my life is a contingent upon us having intimacy right now. And if you can not put all the weight of God upon sex, then you don't have to demand from your wife or your husband. You can woo, request, ask, serve. This text is also saying, though, that intimacy should be frequent. Do not deprive one another, except when you agree for a time to devote yourselves to prayer. So if the husband or the wife do say, hey, can we not tonight? I'm tired. I don't feel awesome. Maybe that shouldn't always be the response. There is place for that. But if that is normal, Paul is saying, nah, no, this is like communion. There should be a frequency, a regularity to it that reminds you of your covenant again and again and again. So yes, there should be a frequency. For all the reasons we've been talking about throughout our time in the Song of Songs, and we'll talk more about this next week, like we'll get into the average time per week of Christian couples and things like that. But the big idea here is that intimacy should be regular, frequent in Christian marriage. But again, I'll say it. I got a little ahead of myself. Let me say what I wrote. It's not a verse for you to use against your spouse. It's just not. It's not that. I'd say it better, more clearly. Please don't weaponize this verse and weaponize Jesus to fulfill your selfish desires. When you do that, they feel that. They know that. It feels gross. And you further double down on the thinking and the feeling of sex is gross. So if you don't want to do that, please don't do that. This verse is actually for you. This is what you should take. You should take and not think about your spouse at all. You should think, I don't have authority over my body. I should take the posture of self-denial. Godly sexual intimacy is about giving, not demanding, serving, not taking. That's what I'm going to do. That's what you should take away from this. That's my posture. That's where I'm going. Why? Because the gospel calls us to this kind of love. Is God a needy, taking, gimme, gimme, gimme kind of? No, he's a giving, loving, coming not to be served, but to serve. So then life, your Christian life, marital life, if you're in Christ, is one of self-denial, of picking up your cross, dying to yourself, following Jesus. Meaning that he and his desires outweigh me and my desires. And where those are at odds, I'm going to submit to his, not mine. That's denying yourself. In your neighborhood, in your friendships, at work, in church, in the bedroom, the posture of a disciple is self-denial. Why? Because that's how Jesus loved us. He came to serve. Now, if you're like, well, so I shouldn't experience any pleasure, you've taken it too far. Thank you. Way to ruin what I said. It's your fault. No, I'm just kidding. I understand that. Like, that's an objection. I know what I just said, so it makes sense. You're like, oh, so like self-denial, like it should be stoic aestheticism where I don't smile even the whole time? No. Again, that's Greek thought, not Christian thought. Look at the song. There is so much joy, adoration, fun, excitement in one another, communication of their visual inventory. This is not that. Yes, there's a lot of pleasure here. That's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is your posture should be to serve her, to serve him. That's it. Now, I'll say one last thing. The essence of sin is selfishness, so the essence of grace is selflessness. And that would be good for you, for your marriage, for your sex. It's to choose servanthood. To choose servanthood over selfishness would to be choose grace over sin. To run to God's grace rather than your own your sexual sin, your sinful desires, whatever. Now back to these two. They're in a fight or in a tiff, maybe in a dream, but they're not synced up. She's wrestling with it emotionally now. Maybe she feels convicted. Maybe he's out there pouting a bit. We don't know. I do know men, so that's why I guess. But she hit up her friends, and what do they say? Verse 9, the young women say, what makes the one you love better than another, both beautiful of women? What makes him better than another? That you would give us this charge, that you would tell us this. And then, this is her big kind of response as he did in the last chapter. And she just goes through why he should be found, why she's lovesick over him, why like above, head and shoulders, everyone else. He'll say, everyone else is like bushes, you're a lily, the lily. And then she's saying the same thing about him, and why? Well, she says, verse 10, my love is fit and strong, radiant and ruddy, glowing with health. It's the idea. Notable among 10,000. His head is pure as gold. His hair is wavy, black as a raven. Not gold hair, but glowing complexion. And his hair is black as a raven. Dark. And that word hair, though, is actually the same word used earlier for his wet hair. So this kind of connects that too, so it makes you feel like this is a missing person report, in a way. They're like, who is he? How do we find him? Why is he so lovely above everyone else? And she's like, well, black as a raven, his hair, fit and strong, wavy hair, like palm clusters is the idea. Verse 12, his eyes are like doves, beside flowing streams, washed in milk and set like jewels. One author writes, I like this. I don't know if I put this up there, Jeff. In her beloved, the woman recognizes herself. The same myrrh that drips from her hands drips from his lips, and in his eyes, she recognizes the same flame of love, dove, which shines in hers. Love makes out of the two only one flesh. It's that idea that we talk about, like, they're 80 and they're very similar. Me and Kayla and I joke about it now, like, this year we've talked about it a lot, about like, oh, you're like me now. And sometimes it's not good things. We're like joking, like, oh, wait, I forget stuff. I've never done that before. I'm like you now. How did this happen? Back and forth. But that's what happens in marriage. It's just the simple principle of friendship, of you become like the people you hang out with. And if you hang out with your wife or your husband all the time, you're going to become more and more like them in friendship and in marriage. That's what she's saying. It's like, oh, you think my eyes are doves, your eyes are doves. Oh, the myrrh, yes, the myrrh. Like, I see these back and forth. And then she goes to his cheeks, like beds of spices, mounds of perfume. His lips are lilies, dripping with flowing myrrh. And now, like he did, she moves down from his face to the rest of his body. But you should note here, I say that to say, the image moves from like organic and in nature to now it's wood and stone. It's like sculpture and architecture. You can sense her comments coming when I say that, right? Like, my lover, you got a hard body. That's what she's saying. Okay, here it is. Verse 14, his arms are rods of gold set with beryl. His body is an ivory panel covered with lapis lazuli. What does that mean? His belly is a plate of ivory. That's what she's saying. It looks like a plate of ivory. His legs are alabaster pillars set on pedestals of pure gold. His presence is like Lebanon, as majestic as the cedars. His mouth is sweetness. He is absolutely desirable. This is my love. This is my friend, young women of Jerusalem. After calling him a young stag earlier, you might imagine this does seem different. Maybe it's just to highlight he's fit and strong, but the image of a statue made of cold, hard stone, what may be happening, because this is poetry, this is song, what might be happening is, as she's describing, yes, she's saying he's a hard body, but also she's describing him not like a young stag. She could articulate these things in nature. She doesn't here. And many people wonder, like, well, then is she maybe communicating? She loves him, he's wonderful, but also he's cold, hard, and distant from me right now. Like, there's a distance from us. And I don't know if I go meet him again or we come back to her and I see him again, I don't know if he's going to respond well. I don't know if he's going to forgive. I don't know if we're going to come, like, if we're going to reconcile. I don't know how this is going to work out. And so you got this, ooh, well, what might be happening? Her desire, this is my friend, my darling, my love. And the young ladies respond again. They're like, yeah, we're in this. Let's go help you find him. Where has your love gone, most beautiful women? Which way has he turned? We will seek him with you. Verse 2 of chapter 6. My love has gone down to his garden, to beds of spice, to feed in the gardens and gather lilies. I am my love's, and my love is mine. He feeds among the lilies. What? You know where he is? Like, what? This is the thriller twist of this dream-like scenario. The risky and dangerous search she went through was actually meaningless because she knew where he was the whole time. Like, what? I'm confused by this. But if you think about it, just pull back in, oh, she's not talking about a different location. She's not talking about a different place geographically. The garden is her. Go back to 4:12. Go back to 2:6, 4:5. She is his garden. Grazing in the gardens and gathering lilies. Refer to enjoying the delights of the marriage bed. That's what she's saying. Meaning, not that he's arrived right now, but she can rest assured that he will return. That's what she's singing. I know where he is. In poetry, she's saying, I know where he is. I don't literally know where he is, but I know where he is. We've committed to one another. We've covenanted to one another. I am his. He is mine. So I know he will return to me. Do you feel that confidence? I don't always feel that confidence. In the worst fights you've had in your marriage, do you feel that strong confidence? I know where she's at. She's going to return to me. We've committed. There's been times when I'm like, I don't think she should return to me. Maybe I should dip out. This is terrible. What am I doing? What have I done? And she's saying, I know where he is. He returns to me. He will return to me. Why? Because I'm his garden. Where else would he go? He's covenant to me. I am his. He is mine. In the midst of their conflict, despite their differences, with her indifference, with the rejection, she trusts he will come back to her and they'll be together again. This is going back to Genesis. What God has joined together cannot be so easily separated. That's what she's saying. But here she switches the phrase from 2:16. And she says, my love is mine and I am my love's. In songs and poetry, that's meaningful, intentional. That switch, maybe she's highlighting that earlier she was selfish, but now she's eager to declare she belongs to her lover before claiming any ownership over him. I am his, meaning he owns me, and then she says, yes, I also own him. But that switch just seems like a shift in her heart has happened. I'm going to lean into that. And I'm going to choose selfishness. I'm going to choose servanthood, because you don't have to stay selfish. I know that's very simple, but these are the same things I say to my kids and I say to myself. So I'll say to you, you don't have to stay selfish, because in the midst of it, you believe you have to. I'm telling you beforehand right now, you don't have to stay selfish. You don't. It is not the boss of you. It is not the master of you. You are not led around by your own selfish desires, and you have to submit to it and say, yeah, just take me along. You don't have to. You don't have to stay selfish. When Jesus says he came to set people free, it even means free from forcing yourself into the center of everything. It even means being free from living with the weight of being the hero, the central character of the cosmos. That's selfishness. For freedom, he has set you free. Free from saying yes to every desire you have. Free from having to choose yourself over your spouse. Free to give yourself to the other. Free to consider your spouse more than yourself. You don't have to stay selfish. This is why he's made you free, so that you could live free. Free to confess sin, free to forgive the other, free to reconcile, free to be friends and not be enslaved to hostility. This is my love. This is my friend. Come back to Gottman. He, in his research, says, yes, this is a big deal. He says this, happy marriages are based on a deep friendship. By this, I mean a mutual respect for and enjoyment of each other's company. These couples tend to know each other intimately. They are well-versed in each other's likes, dislikes, personality quirks, hopes, and dreams. They have an abiding regard for each other and express this fondness not just in the big ways, but in little ways day in and day out. Friendship fuels the flames of romance because it offers the best protection against feeling adversarial toward your spouse. Go back, 70%. It's really what we're really looking for. Friendship. And the word the New Testament uses for this friendship, is fellowship. And I like that word because it conveys friendship so much better. To me, friendship now has been dulled down to a sitcom in the 90s. Fellowship. You know what fellowship means? Sharing or communing with each other. Sharing each other's joys. Sharing and bearing each other's burdens. Sharing face to face. Sharing secrets like God did with Moses. Being intimately involved in one another's lives. So, let's end on some wisdom, because this is in the wisdom genre in the Bible. Let's end some wisdom for friendship. Essentially, share, okay? Share your life with your spouse. Share your inner life with your spouse. What I said, God spoke with Moses face to face and divulged his secrets, divulged his inner life, divulged his divulge what's going on inside of God. It's hard to even try to convey because that's not real, but the things he's thinking about and planning and promising, he tells Moses before anyone else, like they're best friends face to face. Share your inner life with your spouse, your dreams, your fears, your thoughts, your doubts, your belief. There is a possibility to be married for 40 years and to hide massive amounts of your inner life, even from your spouse. It's very possible. I've seen it. I also see the consequences of it. Sad. It's lonely. It's a tenant situation. Roommates under a house, but not intimately sharing a life. Our hearts. Sharing. Share your friendship with Jesus. It's easy to break a 2-cord rope, much harder to break a 3-cord rope. In your marriage, it should be 3 chords. You, your spouse, and your king. And when he's not there, it's much easier to break your cord, the two of you. Now, am I saying he's not there all the time? No, I'm saying in you and how you practice and function in your life. And if you even acknowledge him or submit to him as if he is there. Share your trust. Proverbs 18:24 says this, there's a friend who stays closer than a brother. And that's what I love about her and what she says. Like, I know where he is because I know he'll return to me. I trust he will return to me. I trust that what he said in our vows, I trust he's going to live by that. And so even if he's frustrated with me right now, even if he feels hurt by me right now, he will return to me because covenant is greater than circumstance. So our love is going to go forward because we are loved, and I don't need that person to love me so I feel okay. God has loved me so I can love them, commit to them, stick with them, stay with them, return to them again and again and again. Share your trust. Proverbs 31 says this, the heart of her husband, speaking of this wife, in Proverbs 31, the heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will not lack anything good. She rewards him with good, not evil, all the days of her life. It is a lovely thing for a husband to trust his wife. and to be able to trust his wife. And then Proverbs 19 says, everyone is a friend of one who gives gifts. Don't be a fair-weathered friend. What's our culture? Don't love bomb your wife with gifts to try to wash out the day in and day out sin, disrespect, indifference, and coldness. Try not to wash that out with one love bomb of gifts, of flowers and chocolate and all of your gushy. What she wants is your regular, faithful, strong, committed, I'm in this for you. And sometimes it's fiery, it's not always, but he's here and he loves me day in and day out. That's what I want. I hope that's what you want, ladies, but that's what I think you want. Rather than, oh, he treats me indifferent the whole week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, but then he spends a lot of money on me. I don't think you want that. Last thing, I'll quote two old men. Sorry, dead men. Richard Becker says this, it is a mercy to have a faithful friend that loveth you entirely and is as true to you as yourself, to whom you may open your mind and communicate your affairs, and who would be ready to strengthen you and divide the cares of your affairs and fame with you and help you to bear your burdens and comfort you in your sorrows and be the daily companion of your life and partaker of your joys and sorrows. It is a mercy. So maybe this again starts with what we said previously of being grateful for what you've been given. Is it perfect? Is it maybe exactly what you think it was going to be? No. But can you sit for a second and think what you've been given? And then think what you could cultivate together. You don't have to stay selfish. You don't have to stay in a brutal marriage. And you don't have to stay in a using marriage. This could be beautiful. Why? Because Jesus always makes things lovely and beautiful and restores what's broken and takes Chernobyl-like marriages and turns them into radiant, glowing gardens. I shouldn't say radiant in that sense, but you know what I mean. Yeah. The flowers are glowing. Sorry. But that's what Jesus does. And of course, share your sexuality. Share trust, share your inner life, share thoughts, just share your sexuality, pursue another, enjoy the mutual ownership, do the hard work outside of the bedroom to enjoy the fruit in the bedroom. Matthew Henry in the 1600s wrote of being always ravished with the love of a faithful, virtuous wife. Christianity is not prude. God has given us as a sweet gift to enjoy in marriage. Now, obstacles will come, rejection, insecurities will happen, you will sin against your spouse, but Jesus' love has set you free to keep going, set you free to be able to own your sin, confess it, put it to death, ask for forgiveness. The garden of your marriage can be and will be difficult. It'll take a lot of cultivation and work, but it's worth it because it's been given to you, and it gets to display the full reality that you are loved, cherished, washed clean, and have a certain future and hope because you have an adorable, gorgeous, beautiful, fit and strong husband, Jesus. And he'll return. And just like the wife, we can trust he will return. Where is he? He will return, and he'll take me and will be with me, and this is our life forever and ever. Amen. Let's pray. Lord, help us to continue to pursue, befriend, forgive, serve, die to ourselves, like you have loved us, like you've served us, like you cared for us. Cherish us. Lord, help us. We need mercy. Your mercy. In Christ's name, amen.